New ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. Today, I'm interviewing Steve Kazanjian, the president and CEO of Promax BDA, the global industry association representing more than 10,000 companies and individuals engaged in the marketing of television and video content on all platforms. He's responsible for overseeing all operations and growth for the organization, which draws members from more than 65 countries and is the leading global resource for education, community, creative inspiration, and career development for its members. Steve is a brand marketing executive with an entrepreneurial spirit and has had a long career building agencies from the ground up, shaping entertainment brands, and launching top-tier network packages globally. His cross-category work has earned him numerous industry awards and recognition, including two Emmy Awards for title design, Innovator of the Year Award, multiple Promax BDA Awards, and ADA, Telly, and CTAM Award. He sat on the title design committee for the Emmy Awards for 2 years and has been adjunct professor for Otis College of Art and Design in Los Angeles. Steve, thanks so much for joining us today. First, I wanted to talk a bit about piracy, and we had conducted a survey that found that piracy was really rampant among young millennials, that 69% were pirating content and 67% didn't think there was anything wrong with it. And shortly after we did our study, something really interesting came out. Forbes had found that during the debates, and this is free content, mind you, 41% were pirating the debates. So then it sort of makes you think piracy isn't just about distribution and access, but it's also about promotions and knowing, like knowing what's on. And so that sort of made me think that this might be, you know, is piracy, like how does piracy relate to knowing and discovery of content? And if you had any thoughts around that.
Yeah, without a doubt. Well, first of all, I'm excited to be here with you and thank you so much for the opportunity to speak with you. The issue I look at, you know, in my strategic thought always goes to is say, okay, what are the pre-existing rituals, routines, or behaviors in which you can pull from to understand the context of this? And to me, I wonder if the conversation is not necessarily about piracy, but it's more about ease of access to the content or to the information. Because you can easily draw a parallel to, a BitTorrent and LimeWire in that, you know, mid-90s to late-90s to early-2000s, audio pirating, music pirating, and then in comes iTunes with an ecosystem and a good price point, and that literally, it doesn't dry up overnight, but it doesn't become the significant problem that it was at rampant problem at that time. So I'm not sure if it's necessarily about the fact that they're seeking out to find, wow, I need to find the debates, but I'm not going to pay for it. I want to get it pirated. Or is it more about the fact of like, you need to make it as easy as possible for me to actually access the content? So is it a distribution issue more than it is a pricing issue?
Well, I guess, yeah. I mean, it's just that you have the debates were everywhere and they were free. And why were they choosing to use? I mean, I guess your point is maybe ease of use, so user experience. I mean,
or more importantly, if you're talking about a demo that has pre-existing behaviors.
So they're already going to the pirate site, so it's just that's where their destination anyway, maybe?
Yeah. I mean, like, I remember talking to someone, this goes back maybe 15 years, and it was right when DVDs were slowly declining and the early stages of streaming, and people, they were saying, oh, no, you know, I think we've got another 10 years on fixed media, you know, on DVDs. And I'm looking at it, I'm like, what are you talking about? I go, do you have kids? He said, yeah. Well, do your kids, do they actually buy DVDs or rent DVDs? No. They just look at everything on YouTube. It's over. But the point being is that I believe the argument is more about understanding what platforms that demo is on and making sure that you can connect to them on that demo, because you're asking a lot of them. You're asking them to say, hey, I'm getting it for free over here, but now I'm going to move to another platform that I'm not familiar with, that doesn't have as much emotional context to me, and I'm going to pay for it. I'm not saying it's not right, but I'm just saying you have to, as marketers, we have to look at understanding the pre-existing behaviors of the demo and how do you connect with them on that platform versus trying the Herculean task of moving them to another platform.
Well, I have to say that that's a little frightening because if that's the issue, because if you have, you know, it's really hard to change a behavior in any case, and certainly a behavior that they don't think is wrong is hard to change. And then what you've got is, I really do think it is user experience because they're in this happy place and it's serving them well. So you have to create a joyful environment for them. And let me tell you, a lot of the places out there right now, not so much joy in those environments.
Well, the argument that they don't want to pay for content is just plainly not true. Right. If you think about it, they're paying more for content than ever before. Thinking about console gaming, right? The explosion of console gaming, people are paying a significant amount of money for access to that content.
Right.
The trick is really about the type of content which they're used to getting for free, that in their ecosystem or in their life and as they've grown up, they've always gotten it for free. It's got to be something far more significant to actually get them to pay for it. And I don't think that's the right way to go about it at all.
Right, right. Although I do think, I mean, one of the things that's interesting is they've done economic studies around the music piracy, and they've found that the impact wasn't as great as people had thought because the people who were pirating the music weren't likely to be buying it, and so that they became mm-hmm. early adopters and evangelists for the music. And I'm not sure if you can draw the straight comparison with the video piracy. Certainly, Richard Plepler at HBO feels that piracy is promotion, and he is, or at least officially, that's what he says. And so, you know, Game of Thrones is pirated, but it creates social reverb and makes them part of the cultural conversation. And so it's okay, or at least that's the line. I don't know. Do you think that that's true, that there's a certain amount of piracy as promotion?
I mean, I don't think you can make a broad argument for it. I think it's contingent upon what platform are you? Is an ad-based model? Is a subscription-based model? Mm-hmm. Or is it content marketing that is being used to drive behavior somewhere else? How are you really monetizing the brand? If you're monetizing that brand in another vertical, then ultimately the piracy is just marketing. But I think that the on the flip side of it is to say, if that content is inherently always going to be pirated, then why are we going to put our dollars in there? And if we don't put our dollars in there to actually drive, you know, incredibly high value content, incredibly expensive content like Game of Thrones, does that channel ultimately, or does that platform dry up?
Right. Well, I mean, I suppose then you sort of look to newspapers, right, where you have high end content, which was being given away for free for a very long time, and then how they have to sort of claw their way out of it. But jumping around, I'm curious about best practices in promotion, if we're talking about discovery and promotion. And there was an interview with you, I think maybe 2 years ago, with Magid about surveying and best practices. And I'm wondering, since then, have you seen industry best practices emerge?
I think that there's a lot more understanding on what social platform is more valuable at what time of the day for what demographic. And that to me is really, really interesting. Mm-hmm. I mean, even looking at the behaviors of my kids who are now 9 and 12, and the 12-year-old is an enormous consumer of social media, obviously. And she has two specific times in the day which she's on Instagram. It's mm-hmm. on the way to school and on the way back from school, and maybe a little bit right before she goes to bed. I mean, that's her prime time. You know, that's where she is. She's consuming disposable free content. That's an amazing opportunity to do retargeting and influencer marketing in that channel. So I think the same holds true with Facebook, same holds true with Twitter and Snapchat. I think we're just starting to get our handle around this, going from the spray and pray model of just throwing out all the promos and all the marketing everywhere and every channel and hoping that something sticks, until being into a much more targeted and scripted journey across all those different verticals.
Right. I mean, one of the people we talked to, Michael Zimblist at Simul Media, they had a session, they have a salon series, and they had a guy from Facebook talking about how the exponential increase when you have the ad on TV and also in the social platform, it's not just two times the exposure, then how it ramps up is very, very significant. The other thing that he had, a bit of fact, which I found really interesting, was that I think it was 6% of the population is responsible for 87% of the streaming.
Wow.
Yeah, right? We're in a bubble, like, you know, mm-hmm. a lot. Mm-hmm. And then also some incredible large number of people don't have access to broadband. That's the other thing, which is interesting. So we're all working in this world, which will be the future. And we feel like it is the future right now, but it isn't for a lot of people, which is why some of those ad dollars and the experience, the linear TV stuff, is still very relevant for a lot of people.
Yeah, local is still an enormous market, and it's an enormous part of the overall viewership for your traditional broadcast television. But I think that, to me, it's the opportunity moving forward is more about when we talk about multi-platform marketing or 360-degree marketing, I think it's more about how do you continue the story or how do you create an additive experience on these other platforms versus the same experience across different platforms, as if it's a different distribution channel ultimately for the same bit of content, versus saying, I understand the behaviors, the traits, the idiosyncrasies of this platform and what the consumer or the viewer expects to see and experience on that platform, and to build it out appropriately. I think we're just now starting to understand that.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. This morning, I was at a Paley Center thing with Louis DiComo, who's the Senior VP Global Media for Unilever, and he was talking about how they look at they have multi-screen planning, and it's one single strategy for a connected world. And I think that, you know, we're seeing the brands do that. And as a person who works at promoting content, that isn't always what we're seeing from the networks in terms of how they're approaching their content. Because sometimes when we're, you know, saying, they'll say, oh, well, we have a spot. And we'll say, yeah, well, that's great. You know, what's the whole campaign? What's the whole story? And they're like, oh, well, that's digital. We haven't really thought about that yet. Or we're not in that. We're not responsible for that. And that seems to be something that ought to shift. No?
Yeah, well, Unilever has one thing, enormous advantage that traditional entertainment, linear digital content don't, which is they've been deeply involved with data since the birth of modern branding, right? You know, I'd say mid-50s, and you're going back into understanding individual user behavior of basket rings, first moment and second moment of truth, and driving those conversions. And so they understand the value of promoting and marketing differently on different platforms and how they all work together. That data back approach is something that we are just now starting to understand and understand how to harness, and understanding the expectations of the consumer. You know, if I think about it from a CPG standpoint, from a consumer packaged goods or the Unilever experience, okay, if one of my products is in a convenience store versus in a pharmacy versus a box retailer versus in a supermarket, I'm marketing it completely differently because the consumer expectation is different, and how I'm going to communicate it out and what platform is going to be different as well. And I think those are the best in case practices, strategies, and tactics that we need to employ within this space, or deploy in this space, to actually drive the behaviors that we want.
Well, one of the things that was interesting was he talked about their approach. They sort of have a bifurcated approach where they're seek out content, where they're creating content which viewers are actually seeking out these advertisements, and they're very clever. Mm-hmm. And then there's interruption advertising, which is the reach and scale, the more traditional stuff.
Yeah.
And I mean, when you think about the seek out content, that's where entertainment marketers have a huge advantage, because what they're selling, people want. People will watch iTunes Apple trailers. They'll just, lunchtime, let's watch some trailers. I mean, they're seeking that out. There's a demand for it. So if you're marketing content, you have an advantage over marketing dish soap, yeah?
Well, I think there's I always say it this way, that there's the difference between something as content and it's something that is marketing, is content is something that you seek out irrespective of exactly what it is.
Right.
And marketing is something that's pushed into you, or advertising. I could actually be more specific and say something that's pushed out at you, whether or not you actually want to see it. The future of this entire industry is it's all going to be content. It's all going to be, quote, IP to some extent.
Right. But I mean, right? I guess, though, you know, we'll see sessions where people talk about, you know, sticky campaigns or viral campaigns. And retrospectively, we can all see what's sticky and what's not sticky. The trick is how do you engineer a sticky campaign? And that still feels a bit like the sort of old Steve Martin bit where he says, I'm going to tell you how to make $1 million and not pay taxes. First, make $1 million. Next, don't pay taxes. You know, I mean, are there practices that have become or started to be developed around understanding how to leverage the way communication spreads through social media?
Without a doubt. At the end of the day, it's about whether you want to see it or not. And what's going to define whether you want to see it or not is the emotional value that it contains to you, a recommendation from a peer, one-to-one marketing, a brand extension from something else. There's a value that's associated with it. And the brilliance of the cusp of the world that we're on is that we are going to be able to get into a place, whether that is true one-to-one marketing, right? True peer-to-peer marketing. There's no better place in the world to establish that and to push it than through social channels, because we have the data and we have the behaviors and we understand what those consumers want. So case in point, say I know that you love old school hi-fi receivers more than anyone else, like old vacuum tube receivers. You have an $8,000 turntable and you know everything about, you're an audiophile. You know everything about audio visual, right?
Okay.
And then I got another friend who is a car guy, who always knows the best cars for the prices. He reads all the cars and drivers and blah, 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 blah. You both push out something across whatever social channel. Yeah, you both push out, you know, some kind of
car reference, whatever. And they're going to listen to him rather than me because he's the car file.
Yeah. And the reality is that at the end of the day, I'm defining the value of that marketing message based on my relationship to both of you.
Right.
And so ultimately, if I'm in the market for it, or I value what and a bit of content marketing that he wraps around it, I'm going to go over there and read it. I'm going to bookmark it. I'm going to come back to it. I'm going to remember that's my recommendation, because that's where we're all going, is into that space.
Well, sure. So, it's the context of the content that you're getting.
Right. And so the reason that we haven't been able to do that, because we haven't had that specificity. So the rise of large reach and frequency messages are ultimately because we can't get specific.
But do you think we also, even so, fine, so we don't have the data, but are we doing, with the tools that we do have, are we doing as good a job as we could? I have a bit of an axe to grind, I think, because I've started looking at how social media promotion is, and I don't know that it's clear where I think it does a pretty poor job at informing viewers where to go to find content and which networks host which series. I think they're afraid of pointing. They should pick sort of where to send people. And I don't know that they're doing that. And so as a result, I don't know that people, it sort of gets halfway there, but doesn't close the loop for them. I don't.
Do you mean specifically on
marketing
a
and promotion
brand?
For, yes. Marketing
network
and promotion.
Network brand
of,
versus a show.
Yeah, well, network brand versus a show that if you're pumping your show, the tie-in with your network isn't necessarily as strong as it needs to be.
Yeah, well, the problem inherently is it's the same with CPG. And so you talk about the Unilever reference. Are you a house of brands, or are you a branded house?
Mm.
And you have to make the distinction, and you have to own that. And there's a lot of fear around owning that, because you're letting go of the other side. And so there's going to be a trend where we swing back into specificity. So the rise of basic cable really drove a significant level of specificity on the second tier and the third tier basic cable channels. The consumer knew what they were going to get when they went to that specific network. In the quest to drive ratings, ultimately or to drive that hit, right? Everyone ended up becoming a generalist to a certain extent, and the DNA of what that original brand represented was somehow lost. And we see that across the board, across all those, I would say, tier one and tier two basic cable networks. It's very difficult to understand the difference between one and the other. The brands that will survive are the ones that have a deeper level, I believe, of specificity, which inherently will drive a more emotional context, which will drive the stickiness mm-hmm. to it. And that's that branded house.
Now, right.
The generalists should be a house of brands.
Right.
I believe they need to go back into and define that. Now, the brand doesn't necessarily need to be one show, but it can be a block of programming.
Well, does it in the New World Order, is there such a thing as a block, really? Like, if you're dealing with Netflix, how many shows is a fall season? If people are consuming them in this different way, how many shows is the, you know, it's not.
But I would define a block of programming as not as one linear block of programming. I define it more as in Netflix's Marvel world.
Okay.
So Luke Cage, Jessica Jones, Daredevil, Punisher,
okay.
All those are a block
like,
of programming.
So like genre silos, if you will.
Yeah, they're genre or they're a genre to me would be encompassing the larger superhero
okay.
genre. But to me, it's more about the world that these all connect into.
Huh. Okay.
And that allows you to say, create that heuristic in your mind, that mental shortcut that says, okay, I've already watched all of Luke Cage. I'm now waiting for Iron Fist because I know it's in that same world. And I'm trying to shortcut my decision-making process so I can start watching shows.
Right. A lot of marketing people are afraid of data. Now, because you sit at, you're top of Promax there, what do you think are the key things that they should really understand and be fluent in order to be effective in the new world
right.
where data is important?
Well, data will ultimately make your creative successful. And if you're creative successful, you'll be able to push it further and you'll be able to have more influence over the creative that you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes a virtuous cycle. But the foundation of that great creative, the foundation of all great creative, regardless of the vertical, regardless of the industry, is going to be some bit of data that's converted into some insights. There's very few situations in which you're just going to say, I thought of this great idea and I just pushed it out and I didn't have any data back whatsoever and look at what happened.
I'm a genius.
I'm a genius. So are there outliers? Of course. There are always those outliers, right? There's always those iconoclasts who can do whatever they want and the industry follows.
Right. But not very many.
Not very many.
Not very many and not all the
yeah.
time. Well, and sort of this all comes, brings us to a place where we had been talking the other day about data and data adoption and what it signified in terms mm-hmm. of where an industry had reached. Now, do you want to, I think it was really interesting. And can you share that with the audience?
Oh, without a doubt. So I had spent, my career's bounced back and forth between entertainment and consumer products and consumer packaged goods. And during my time in CPG, we would define a mature market or mature industry by one that was governed by data. And the reason why is that data allowed a very focused attention to the product innovation pipeline. So they were able to do predictive analytics on understanding consumer purchasing behaviors, and then they would build out their product portfolio accordingly. So what we ended up seeing is because of that, because there was such attention, we saw this bifurcation in the product innovation pipeline where the consumers were trading down into very functional products that had very little emotional context to them that just served a specific need. Consequently, because of that, the dollars that were opened up allowed them to trade up into even more higher value emotional products, or what we would call accessible super premiums. So they're not $300, but they are $1.95, and the next product in there maybe 50 cents. So accessible, but still very much of a premium product for that. And it's the middle that would really drop out because it wasn't emotional enough for them to
have that joyful spend, right?
Yeah, to have that joyful spend. But it was still a functional product. But if it's really functional, I don't really care. Why am I spending the money? I can just convert down into a lower price point as it is. And we see that all across the board. And even if there was a middle in there, that middle was still bifurcated out as well. So we saw seeing these striations was really interesting and would allow us to really understand consumer behavior, how they move through it, the rituals, routines, the regimens around that, and then build out our marketing plans accordingly. And over the last 5 years in entertainment, as we continually become more and more data-backed, I believe that you're starting to see that behavior finally come into traditional content and seeing content act more like a CPG, a consumer packaged goods, or a consumer product than ever before, where the consumers are trading down into very, very functional product. And what I mean by that are content. I mean by that is Instagram content, Facebook, YouTube, things that they don't really care to bookmark or to ever get to or find again. But at the same time, there's more high-value content being produced than ever before. This is the new golden era of television. Right. There's more filmmakers moving in television. There's more money putting in television. The most expensive hour of television in the history of mankind was produced last year. There's more competition in that space. So once again, more need for our services as entertainment marketers in that space. But that middle that was occupied by reality, by game show, by talk show, by that world, I wouldn't say it's gone, but it doesn't have the same weight that it used to have. So what's interesting for us is to say the best-in-class strategies still are more relevant than ever before for that very high-value content, and where that content is being treated more like a theatrical launch than ever before.
Well, exactly. Well, you have the content actually is the product, whereas in television, you know, versus film, it wasn't always the product. You know, the ad was the product and the content was sort of wrapped around it.
Exactly.
But I have to say that we have run long. I've taken a lot of your time. So,
oh, wow. I didn't notice that.
See, it was fun. Thank you for your time.
Anytime.
All right, take care. Bye-bye. We've reached the end of our episode, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who've helped bring the program to life. First, my friend, Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded the open. And, of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media. And a big thank you to our guest, Steve Kazanjian. And, of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. And I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.